This is Breakpoint This Week, a weekly briefing on faith, culture, worldview, and mission with John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview.
Welcome to Breakpoint This Week. John Stone Street here along with Warren Smith. And I wonder if we should just set a policy, Warren, that we're going to refuse to talk about politics whenever and wherever possible. I mean, you know, our line around here is that most often, and that it tends to be downstream from the rest of culture, but it tends to dominate our attention. And the dominant story of the week, and to not talk about it would be probably unfair. Yeah. Although it's just incredibly, you know, discouraging for people who are, you know, at the same time trying to stick with their convictions politically, but also want a more civil public square, was this whole incident. What do we call it? Trump versus the squad? Is that what we call it? And it's become quite a fight, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has. And the squad almost sounds dismissive, except that's what they call themselves. And of course, I'm talking about four female congresswomen that led, I think you could say their sort of nominal leader is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York. You know, they've really kind of entered into a full pitched battle against President Trump, accusing him of racism. And it started, I think, well, I don't know if it started. I don't even know where it started. But probably the most recent skirmish came whenever Trump started using language like that they should go back where they came from. One of his tweets said, "Why don't they go back and fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came?" And of course, three of the four were born here in the United States, and the fourth one is a naturalized American citizen. And so a tweet like that called up all kinds of concerns about racism. It brought up sort of language from the 50s and 60s whenever that was often said by racists against African Americans, that they should go back to Africa. And so I think Trump's tweet was ill-advised, the language was poorly chosen, and the send them back chant became a part of a campaign rally that Trump did here in North Carolina, my home state, this week. And so it sort of heightened the tensions even more.
And what's crazy about this is, on a completely kind of political strategy point, and by the way, let's not assume that, you know, this tweet was well thought out ahead of time. No right. One's really suggesting that there was a real strategic plan to this. But to me, it was just kind of strange on a number of levels. The first is this happened directly at a moment when the Democratic Party was fighting each other, where the squad was in a different sort of media battle with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. And there's a real tension there between kind of, okay, get in line, wait your turn, to the squad, which pushes, you know, on the far left of the political spectrum. I mean, when Nancy Pelosi's the moderate, that kind of tells you kind of where we're at on a progressive way of thinking and the progressive agenda items that these four have. And pushing, not wanting to wait, being very critical of Pelosi's handling of a number of things recently. And they had gotten into a media war to the point where kind of Pelosi was on national media outlets saying, you know, look, they're really not that big of a deal. A big Twitter following is not what you need to make a difference in the U.S. House. I mean, it was a really kind of stunning rebuke, kind of from your grandmother, to turn around and say, you know, get back in line, kid. And it was right in the middle of that, right in the middle of that, that Trump decides to step in and unify the Democratic Party again. So that, to me, seemed like a strategic mistake first. The second thing is I think that the progressive agenda items of these four, the squad, are so far to the left that they're outside of the American mainstream. And the economic success that we're currently having, the far left abortion rights views, the progressive identity politics that are pushed by these four, you can win this battle, with ideas, without, kind of going after the individual, without the ad hominem sort of attack. And so that's what's strange to me as well. And whenever Trump does this, this is interesting. It does two things. It secures an extreme part of his base. And I think that's the chance that we saw in North Carolina. That, to me, was more disturbing. Not that you dismiss what Trump says. Trump shouldn't have tweeted this. It's foolish. It's dehumanizing. And it doesn't matter who we're talking about. You know, we're talking about four U.S.-born citizens. I think they're completely wrong. I think you could completely have won this whole battle by saying, not go back to whatever country you think they came from, which they didn't, but saying, love this country. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has identified what the squad has said over and over and over is really a disdain for capitalism, a disdain for certain freedoms, and so on. And in other words, you can win this one, you know, without doing it. And what happens, though, when Trump doubles down and does something, you know, extreme like this, it does secure an element of his base, an element that's, I would say, not where a Christian can stand. But then on the other hand, what it does is it bothers a whole lot of people, and his approval ratings go back down again. So it's unwise. And as we all know, Trump, he tried to separate himself from the center home comments from the rally, but it didn't seem convincing to me at all as he was trying to do that.
Yeah, you know, there's an old saying in politics, John, that don't stand between your political opponent and a rapidly advancing freight train. And unfortunately, that seems to be what Donald Trump has done here. He's turned four women who were probably, as you said, pretty marginalized, even within the Democratic Party on the far left of the party, and have turned them into sympathetic characters. And I will also say that, you know, I'm not a prognosticator. As Yogi Berra famously said, predictions are dangerous, especially predictions about the future. But I believe that what Trump did in North Carolina in particular, and of course I live in Charlotte, there is a contested House race going on right now. And in fact, a friend of mine, Dan Bishop, is the Republican candidate in that race. He was at the Trump rally, and I don't think he helped himself. I've known Dan Bishop for many years. He's a very committed Christian guy. He's a lawyer, a smart guy. And I think he's going to get tagged, at least with accusations of racism, because of this particular rally. So it's not been a good week for President Trump, and you know, we'll just have to see if he can recover from it. He is trying to distance himself from the send them back rhetoric. But, you know, sometimes that stuff just explodes spontaneously whenever you have 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 people in an arena.
Yeah, and this is the thing. Trump's chances moving forward in the 2020 are strong, and the reason that they're strong is because the Democratic Party has not just moved to the left. I mean, they're so far to the left. Again, when Joe Biden is the moderate in the race, when Nancy Pelosi is the moderate one in this whole, you know, kind of kerfuffle in the House, this tells you, you know, where this goes. And that's just not where most Americans are. And that's certainly what drove the turnout that the president got in 2016. And it's unnecessary. Now, look, I'm not sure, just as Trump cannot distance himself here, the Democratic candidates are going to have a hard time distancing themselves here. And I think what the president was trying to do is basically say, look, this is where the Democratic Party is, and kind of, you know, put all the Democratic Party at the same agenda level as the squad, and kind of push them further to the left. That may or may not be a successful strategy, but, you know, more than that, it's just not something we say. And there's just been a whole lot of thing I want to talk about, too, and we'll probably get some emails on this, is, you know, is it racism, what he said? Trump's hired many people of color. He works with people of color. There's people of color that support him. You know, there's an America First that gets equated with nationalism and racism. There is a form of America First that is nationalism and racist, without a question. A lot of times, people's followers behave even worse than the people that they're following. And we've seen that throughout history. And I think all of that has been at work when we've seen kind of the worst elements of kind of the alt-right and so on over the last, you know, 4 years. But when you got to parse it that much to prove that it's not racism, let's just say this, it was a dumb tweet. It was something that, and
that's
what
right.
was interesting is that it was just at a group with a bunch of individuals, and a really strong Trump supporter said to me, the irony of the timing was just funny. You know, it's like, I think somebody may have taken Twitter out of Trump's hands because he hasn't done any 2 a.m. tweets that, you know, in the last several months. And then this happened like the next day. So apparently Twitter is back. But but it also tells you about the problem of Twitter and political and cultural rhetoric. These are things that shouldn't try to be said in that many characters or less. And it's become a medium where people are far more comfortable saying things that they wouldn't say in public.
That's right.
And that's another issue, another part of this whole story that we need to continue with. And by the way, I mean, you know, you can line up the tweets of Ocasio-Cortez and find things that most of the Democratic Party and most Democratic voters wouldn't want to associate themselves with either. So Twitter has become not good for political rhetoric, if you ask me. Well, you're listening to Breakpoint This Week. John Stone Street here with Warren Smith. We'll be right back.
We invite you to visit Breakpoint.org. While you're at our website, be sure to browse our online Colson Center store of great books and other resources. And you can link up to our social media sites like Facebook and Twitter.
Well, we're back on Breakpoint this week. John Stone Street here, along with Warren Smith. The other big and shocking story for many this week was the forced departure of Leanna Wen, the president of Planned Parenthood. Leanna Wen was hired to be the president. What was the last president's name? I'm just blanking out here, Warren. What was her?
Richards. What was her name?
Cecile Richards. And yeah, Cecile Richards was really... One of the things you can say is that the expansion of federal funding and the focus on abortion rights that Cecile Richards led for Planned Parenthood, she was more of a political figure. But near the end of her tenure, many of us predicted that the sort of thing that she did would come back to bite Planned Parenthood because she was so radical in this, and she had so separated the organization from any sort of medical oversight and that sort of thing. In order to rebuild Planned Parenthood's image as a medical provider, quote unquote, Leanna Wen, a physician, was hired as the president, but that didn't last long.
It sure didn't, John. She was only there about 8 months, and as you say, she was a doctor, but she didn't have the kind of political skills that Cecile Richards had, and that has started to show up, especially because we do have a Republican administration. Just this week also, Title X funding was cut, about $60 million that Planned Parenthood had received in Title X funding was cut, and that was a big deal. I think that might have been a precipitating moment. There's been a little bit of a sub-current about Leanna Wen as well. She had a miscarriage, apparently, recently, and people have been talking about whether that might have affected her own personal views about, you know, when life begins. And in fact, our friend Abby Johnson, who was the subject of the book and the movie Unplanned, actually tweeted whenever she was fired, hey, if you want to talk to somebody, give me a call. And I thought that was a very, very gracious way to deal with that particular situation. It wasn't gloating. It wasn't triumphalist. It was, you know, saying, hey, you've been fired. You just had a miscarriage. You may be a woman in pain. And if that's true, we'd love to talk. And I really appreciated Abby Johnson's tweet in that regard.
You know, one of the things, though, that comes out, and of course, there's been a dispute. Leanna Wen has kind of communicated her version of the events, that her and the new board chairs had philosophical differences. She famously said that abortion was a health care issue, not a political one. And certainly needing a more aggressive political leader in light of the real blows that Planned Parenthood has suffered. And I think there's two reasons for that. Number one is you do have an administration that hasn't just talked pro-life. They've actually taken steps to move the ball downfield. And a lot of the people in that administration are people that have been in the pro-life movement for a long time. And you also, on the other hand, you've got, I think at some level, Leanna Wen was the victim of the extremism of Cecile Richards, right? So she pushed the language, and she so expanded the abortion services to be front and center financially for the organization that to try to present Planned Parenthood as a more broad medical provider, the math doesn't work based on, despite the claims that we hear over and over and over again that abortion is just 3% of Planned Parenthood services. It ain't 3% of Planned Parenthood's budget, I'll tell you that. So it's a big difference.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, Planned Parenthood's budget, I think that, last I looked, was about $1 billion. So this $60 million cut in Title X funding is, it's going to be noticed, but that juggernaut that known as Planned Parenthood is still going to press on. And I think you're right on another level too, John, that this, even though Leanna Wen called it philosophical differences as the reason for her firing, apparently it was done behind closed doors. It was a surprise to her. And so I don't think we've heard the last of this story. I think it does reflect a split in philosophy within the pro-abortion movement. I think that we'll be hearing more about this in the days, weeks, and months ahead.
Yeah, I think and Lila Rose is one of the many voices that kind of, I think, pointed to something that's absolutely true, is that this whole story has revealed the true nature of Planned Parenthood. She tweeted, Planned Parenthood's priority will always be abortions, not their staff, not the health of women, not basic human decency. It's why hundreds of workers are leaving the abortion industry and why millions more Americans are becoming pro-life. Now, you mentioned Title X funding, and let me go back to that because that was another big story of the week, and we need to talk about what that is. So the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is allowing a new Trump administration rule on Title X funding to go into effect. Now, Title X, you know, involves, you know, again, federal funding going to women's health care organizations. And there's long been kind of restrictions on that prior to the presidency of Bill Clinton, that it couldn't be spent, that Title X funding couldn't be spent on abortion. Well, Bill Clinton opened that door, and it's been open ever since, that as long as it's not directly funding abortion, then it's okay. Of course, that just means you're shuffling around money, right? It becomes an accounting trick to say, well, yes, we received Title X funding. And as you said, it's $60 million a year in Title X funding goes directly to Planned Parenthood, not to mention you know, other abortion providers. But the rule that the Trump administration put out several months ago prohibits any grant recipients from performing abortions or even having abortion providing in the same facility. So there has to be a real separation. If you're applying for Title X funding, you really just can't be in the abortion business. And of course, it was immediately sued. The rule was sued and was put on hold. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is allowing it now to go forward, and the Trump administration put it immediately into effect. And like you said, $60 million in a budget of $1 billion. Now, look, man, if somebody wants to write the Colson Center a check for $60 million, that would be a completely different story, right?
Exactly. $60
million, hint, hint. But if $60 million in a budget of $1 billion, it's not everything, right? But it's a significant blow. And when you count that this is also applying to abortion providers that are not Planned Parenthood as well, that's, you know, this becomes, you know, real money. And it's interesting to see this kind of go into effect. It was also interesting that this allowance came from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is an interesting reality as well. And the court said by 7-4 vote that it can go forward.
Yeah, that's right, because the Ninth District Court is, you know, traditionally been thought of as the most liberal court, appeals court in the nation. And the fact that they sided essentially with the Trump administration on this particular rule, again, as you said, by a 7-4 vote, it wasn't close, is very significant. And again, like you say, the amount of money is not probably going to affect negatively Planned Parenthood. I'm not sure about that, but $60 million on a $1 billion budget, it's also become big news, so they'll be able to probably do some fundraising that will replace that money. But as Marjorie Dannenfelser with the Susan B. Anthony list said, it draws a bright line in the sand that basically says that family planning and abortion are two separate things, and that the government is not going to fund abortion. Now, unfortunately, the government still continues to fund abortion, both at the federal and the state level. And in fact, the latest number that I heard was that this $60 million is just part of a bucket of money that exceeds $300 million that Planned Parenthood gets from government entities of all kinds. But this is a real step in the right direction, and hopefully it'll just be the first of many that will eventually completely defund Planned Parenthood, which was, we should say, one of President Trump's campaign promises. He's not fulfilled that promise yet, but this is a step in the right direction towards fulfilling that promise.
Well, and it's important to say it's been the promise of many congressional Republicans now for a decade or more, and they haven't fulfilled that promise either, right?
That's,
I mean,
right.
We talked about this, that, you know, and I've had these conversations, and I keep saying, well, listen, it's not getting worse. That's the justification. We're, you know, we can't hold up the budget because we've got to fund other things like the military, but at least we're not giving them more money. And I was like, look, you ran on the promise that Planned Parenthood would be defunded, not funded at the same level, first of all. Second, we're talking about $500 million. I mean, in the last budget, it was $500 million that went to Planned Parenthood. And now to have at least some of that money restricted is a good step. But also, and I think this is worth saying, is that the political football right now has been moving back and forth on executive orders. And executive orders don't last. They last until the next executive gets into the White House. And this is one of those rules applying to Title X that will be scratched day one if a Democrat moves into the White House. Mm-hmm. And so that has to be an important thing that pushes us on a number of levels. Number one, that elections do matter. Number two, that we should hold all of our elected officials to these promises that they made, especially when we're talking about something as serious as hundreds of millions of dollars going to the destruction of unborn life. And then finally, I think we need to remember that this doesn't do a thing in terms of state funding. And again, to beat a dead horse, it's not a dead horse, to beat a very alive horse. Look, states are doubling down on their view of abortion. So we've got New Yorkers high-fiving for infanticide, and we've got Missouri eliminating abortion, and it's going state by state by state, which means every Christian has a role to play in this battle to defend unborn life. You're listening to Breakpoint This Week. We're talking about the issues of the culture from a Christian worldview. Go to breakpoint.org, click on the link for this program that says resources mentioned on the radio and podcast, and we'll link you to the various articles that we have talked about on today's program. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You can learn more about Breakpoint and the Colson Center for Christian Worldview when you visit breakpoint.org. That's breakpoint.org.
You're listening to Breakpoint This Week. I'm Warren Smith with John Stone Street. And, you know, John, there was an important event that took place in Washington. The Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom was attended by our friend at World, Mindy Bells, was organized by the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. I would have to say, though, that a driving force behind the event was Sam Brownback, who is the Ambassador for International Religious Liberty. This is the second ministerial that has been organized under the Trump administration. More than 1,000 people attended and really did highlight international persecution of Christians and the need for religious liberty around the country. One of the big announcements out of the event was an International Religious Freedom Alliance that was being organized that would bring like-minded countries together. At least that was the way Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, described it. All in all, I would have to say a pretty positive move.
Year two and another initiative. Each year has promised an initiative where the state is actually going to take steps to protect this freedom and try to encourage it around the world. Good timing. I'd say, you know, overdue, of course, because the, you know, the role of having even an ambassador for international religious freedom, that has been in place, but it's a post that hasn't always been filled under previous administrations.
And, that's right.
And we've seen, a real, I think, emphasis on this. At the same time, this week we talked about, I think, an upcoming surge of refugees that we're going to get from China. I know that there's tons of stuff happening on the southern border. There's concern about refugees, using asylum as an excuse to infiltrate the country. That doesn't seem to be the case with most of them. There seems to be real persecution at play. But we've got a new kind of direction, and that's coming from China as the Chinese government cracks down on Christian communities, Christian families, and so on. And right now, our refugee policy, even though the administration promised at both levels, both from the president and Vice President Mike Pence also promised that we were going to look after Christians around the world. Well, this is one way that they're doing it, and I definitely appreciate the leading the way and leading the emphasis on religious freedom as a fundamental human right, trying to influence countries that are bad actors and so on and so on and so on. That's all really important stuff. We're also, though, going to have to come to a reckoning with the fact that the number of refugees that we're letting in, especially Christian refugees, I'm not talking about what's happened on the southern border. That's a different issue. I think they're being conflated, by the way.
Yep.
I've said that before. And I think that, by the way, on a completely strategic political step, it would be a huge win for this administration if they would both strengthen our border security and also accommodate people who do deserve asylum because of religious persecution. And yeah, should other countries do this? Yes. And other countries should do this, and so should we. And the numbers of religious asylum seekers gaining refuge in the United States, and we talked about this, we'll link to it if you come to breakpoint.org, has really dropped to just abysmal numbers. And it's something that has to be addressed. So look, religious freedom is not an American right. It is a human right that recognizes who we are as individuals, that our conscience all ultimately belongs to God. Yes, it gets complicated when we start talking about national security and that sort of stuff, but we have got to figure out a way to take care of people that are the victims of religious persecution around the world. And I'd say, especially as Christians, we should care about those that are within our fold, that are facing increased persecution. It's going to be a challenging thing to figure out going forward, and I hope it becomes part of the administration's priorities. And again, I completely applaud this ministerial. I completely applaud the leadership that America is showing around the world. This is the second year we're putting real tangible institutions into the world that are championing religious freedom, not just rhetoric, but institutions. All of that stuff is really, really important. And there's more steps to come, hopefully.
Well, that's right. And, you know, you talk about American leadership and why it's so important. After the first ministerial, Britain, Taiwan, the United Arab Emirates organized similar conferences. Pompeo said that after this second ministerial, that Albania, Colombia, Morocco, and the Vatican were also planning events. It just goes to show you that American leadership still really matters in the world. And it's really been great to see this second ministerial. I do think we should give a lot of credit to Sam Brownback, who has but often you will see if in the photos of Mike Pompeo, you'll see Sam Brownback in the background or just to the side. And he has been involved, engaged in what I would call real servant leadership on this matter of international religious liberty. And I think he should get a lot of props for this as well.
Well, you've been listening to Breakpoint this week. Come to breakpoint.org. Click on the link there that says resources mentioned on the radio and podcast. And also wherever you subscribe to podcasts, if you're not a subscriber currently and you're catching this here and there, you can make sure that you never miss a single Breakpoint commentary and you never miss a single conversation on the stories of the week here on Breakpoint this week. For Warren Smith, I'm John Stone Street. Thanks for joining us. Join us next time.